Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Fantastic. Well, you know what, Paula? Today, our guest is Philippe Caland, whose most recent film really touched my heart. As he brought a subliminal genius message to the screen, I was so excited to see this. The film Ripple Effect is continuing to show at the cinema in downtown San Jose, California. You certainly will come away filled with awe in how the message was brought to the audience. Philippe Caland, born of French-Lebanese descent, has lived in the United States since 1985. And he grew up in Paris and Beirut, attended the American College of Paris, and was part of the French national swim team from 1976 to 1980. Philippe moved to the United States in 1985 and became interested in the film industry in 1987. He wrote the story for Boxing Helena, which Jennifer Lynch adopted into a screenplay in 1993. He also served as producer on the film, and in 1998, Philippe Caland and his co-producer, Sean Penn, were nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for Best Feature for the film Loved. He is also the founder of Echonology, an organization that supports concepts and campaigns that promote environmental sustainability.
Well, Philippe, welcome. You have so many accomplishments. You're a producer, a director, a writer, and an actor, which you did all in this last movie, The Ripple Effect. And it also starred Forrest Whitaker, Marie Driver, and Virginia Madsen. So welcome. And our first question for you, Philippe, is how did you get interested and started in the film industry?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all, and for introducing me the way you did. You
know, Philippe needs to talk up, Paula.
Okay, can you talk up a little bit louder?
Yeah, I will.
Thank you.
My interest. I guess that when you live long enough with ideas that could only materialize through that medium, and that you put your mind to it and you just go ahead and find a way to make it through into the business. So it was really a matter of deciding that it would be the better way for me to express some of my ideas. And that's what brought me into the film business.
And which was the first film you produced?
Well, the first film that I wrote and produced was a film called Boxing Helena, which has become since a cult movie. I wrote it. It was the beginning of my U.S. journey. I had moved in from Paris, and I was living in New York, and my girlfriend at the time, who since has been my wife, and one was an actress, and she was modeling in New York, and she truly wanted to be an actress in Los Angeles. So I told her that I would write a script and put her in it, and I really had fast food restaurants that I was building in New York at the time. So I wasn't in the film business. I was really just testing my way through, the system and finding a way to make a living. So once I had gotten my platform in New York, as a young entrepreneur that was, trying to make a living, I decided that I would try writing something for a woman I loved, and I wrote Boxing Helena. At that point, once I had the manuscript, I had the document. I said, okay, well, now let me try to make it into a movie, and I came to Los Angeles. I sold, the chicken franchises, those were chicken restaurants I had in Manhattan. I sold, five or six of them that I had at the time, and I came out to Los Angeles, and I settled in Los Angeles, and I did, and I made it happen, and I produced Boxing Helena, and I actually ended up putting my wife in it.
So you said now it's a cult movie?
I'm sorry? It's a cult movie, yeah. Boxing Helena is a cult movie. It's clearly no longer the kind of movie that I would make today. But 15 years ago, I was racier in my state of mind. So I just went ahead and I did a movie that is more in the surreal genre. It was directed by Jennifer Lynch, who's the daughter of David Lynch, and he's a cult director in that is one of the most established worldwide. So we brought that a surreal, you know, off the wall, cultish, story to the screen, and it exists, it's out there, and I receive a lot of emails from people about Boxing Arena. The truth of the matter, I would not make that same movie again today because I've changed into a different person.
So, what do you like to do the best? The writing, the producing, the directing, or acting? You did a very good job acting in this last movie.
Thank you. Thank you. I love telling stories. I would say that this is really what I like to do the most, is telling a story that is different and authentic and creates. Is this better? Then I get very restless, and it cannot sit on a shelf too long without me wanting to take some action. So if something I wrote is still in my mind and present and part of my consciousness a few months after it's been written, then I pretty much decide that no matter what, I'm going to go ahead and do it. So, you know, my way of taking the bull by the horn is to actually go out and decide that I'm going to direct it. So, you know, the natural progression of my writing is because I'm that kind of a guy that needs to get it done at some point, I just decide to go and direct it, because the alternative would be to wait on another director to decide that it's the right time in his life to make a film. And I don't want to wait on somebody else's decision to trigger, you know, the making of a movie that I'm passionate about. So that's how I made myself a director. And then, you know, the same dynamic applies to me also acting in it. Because once I've decided that I'm going to be directing a movie, then it becomes a matter about, you know, I need to get the actors. And there is a very tedious waiting list in Los Angeles to get a hold of the right actors, because the bigger companies book them way ahead of time, and it's almost impossible to get a shot at them, especially when you're a small independent movie without much money. So I decided that I would also act, because usually I write characters that I relate to, and those are stories that I want to purge out. So I feel that why not myself act in those films? Now, what happened with The Ripple Effect is that, you know, I had done a movie a year or two earlier called Hollywood Buddha, which was an experimental film that ended up winning festivals and doing well. It's a film that I wrote also and directed and starred in, and I cast Hollywood Buddha really at street corners and in coffee shops with people who were not actors, and I felt very comfortable, you know, with the process of making a movie with people who are not established actors. I felt that there is a certain authenticity that comes in the work, because nobody has a high expectation, nobody's really striking poses, and nobody's trying to win an Academy Award, so there's no pressure, and it becomes a very loose work format that I enjoyed, you know, the first time around. So when I decided that I would do Ripple Effect as a director, I said, okay, well, I'm going to do it the way I did Hollywood Buddha, which means that I'm going to start acting in it. And I was shooting the first few scenes of Ripple Effect when some people here in town who are part of the establishment, you know, and who had seen Hollywood Buddha and enjoyed it as a movie, you know, suggested that maybe I should be speaking with some established actors to make this movie. And my first reaction was, you know, I'm already shooting this movie. What are you talking about? I don't want to stop it now. You know, plus the process is too tedious. From I don't have the stomach for that process. And they told me, well, why don't you give it a try? And at that point, a call was made to the agent of Forrest Whitaker. And Forrest had seen Hollywood Buddha, and he was doing Idi Amin Dada in Uganda, for which he won the Academy Award. And then he and I have a phone conversation, which initially was a courtesy phone call that his agent had arranged for me, not knowing if it would materialize into Forrest's interest in the film, but it has. And after a good conversation that Forrest and I had, he decided right there on the phone, without even reading a script, that he wanted to work with me for having seen actually Hollywood Buddha and for really hearing me discuss Ripple Effect and what I wanted to make of it. And then I had to stop production, let the crew go for a couple of weeks, wait for Forrest to finish his movie, come back to Los Angeles, and I restarted production when Forrest arrived in Los Angeles, and all of a sudden it became a movie that had stars in it, because the minute Forrest decided that he was going to do Ripple Effect, you know, other stars like Minnie and Virginia became interested in the project, and it became actually a Ripple Effect, of course, and we ended up making the movie the way you've seen it.
Well, so the movie itself was a Ripple Effect.
Well, yeah, because it manifested in ways that were not planned. I mean, there was nothing about this movie that I had planned when I decided to go out and make it. For me, there was a story I wanted to tell. I was actually starting to talk to somebody who was swimming laps with me at the YMCA at the time, asking him if he wanted to be the guy in the wheelchair, and he was a professor at UCLA, you know, a theology professor at UCLA, and I almost used him. If it wasn't for Forrest showing up and wanting to make this movie, you know, this guy would have probably ended up being the guy I would have acted against.
Well, you fall in love with Philippe, that's for sure.
I'm sorry?
With Philip. You fall in love with
Philip.
Philip in the movie. It's, you know, he is so genuine, and he comes across. It's really, truly awesome.
And I think it was really good that he's black, because that made a more of an impression on what was going on in the movie. I don't know if you agree with me.
But I fully agree with you. You know, I agree with you. And also, you know, the fact that I'm an immigrant in America actually made that, took it yet to another dimension altogether. So I think that the chemistry and the combination of Forrest being, you know, black African-American and me being, you know, just Lebanese Middle Eastern immigrant in America, you know, became an interesting dynamic, I think. I think it worked for the movie.
And I read some trivia about Virginia Matson.
Yes.
She, her mother is half Aboriginal.
Yes.
And that, I thought that was unusual too.
Yes. Yes. Well, but Virginia is really a real American lady in every sense. I mean, she could be an American poster girl in a lot of ways.
So now Forrest played in the phenomenon with John Travolta.
Yes.
And it's kind of metaphysical. And is he interested in that subject?
Well, it's the subject of Ripple Effect, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's what brought him on board. I mean, Forrest has a lot of integrity, artistic integrity, and he only takes on projects that are challenging. But Forrest has just so much to contribute to any movie that is presenting a certain mindset that requires, depth, spirituality, living in the moment, and the broader notion that we are all connected. So I think that, you know, he has the spiritual connection to, you know, His mindset is just, you know, as advanced in that topic as anybody I know out in Los Angeles and possibly around the world. I mean, he truly is a very evolved and sophisticated person. So for him, the notion of being a victim who's not a victim, and a person who relieves me from my own pressures related to the accident and guilt, when he's really the recipient of my action in ways that anybody would have harbored anger into five lifetimes to come, you know, he's let it all go, and he's become a better person as a process of that accident. And so in that sense, I think that, you know, really Forrest Whitaker it was godsend for Ripple Effect. Not only it happened in the most unconventional of ways, it happened without him reading a script, It happened from a phone conversation we had over on different continents at odd hours. And I don't have the credentials as a filmmaker, you know, to get somebody like Forrest Whitaker truly interested from my professional background. So it had to be the story that touched him in a way for him to commit to doing it, and it had to be his own sense that he could contribute greatly to the work, which he has.
My favorite scene in the movie is when your eyes are teared up and you're looking at Philip, who Forrest plays in the wheelchair, and he's telling you the story.
Yeah.
I thought that particular moment was made the movie.
It did, absolutely.
I think I agree with you, and so I have to credit and thank forever Forrest Whitaker for that moment, because he brought, I think, it's a gem, you know, that would have elevated any movie, you know, it belonged in.
You could hear a pin drop.
that's the magic he brought to the movie, and I think that the movie may end up existing because of that moment that Forrest brought into it. Everything
mm-hmm.
else, you know, I'm proud of, but this is a moment that I cannot take credit for. It's Forrest's moment, and it's really the gift that he gave the movie.
It really brings you back to yourself after he speaks. It's just like, oh my God, what a statement, you know. It was really outstanding.
And it's a type of movie, like I told Taz, that you could see more than once and get something more out of it.
It seems that people who see it more than once get even more engaged than the first time around. I have people who have seen this movie a few times, and like a few times later, they come to me and they say, you know, there is this thing that I didn't notice before, and it just ties up together. It's a thinking movie that you have to be engaged by it to really go through wanting to basically take it all in. And because every layer of it and every piece of it is one that makes you somehow think, you know, if you drop the ball at any given time, you know, then you still can remain engaged by it. But you quite often, I mean, all of us as an audience drop the ball, you know, in any movie we watch at any given time. So it is not about this movie in particular. I mean, we get at times we just drop the ball a bit, you know. So those people who see Ripple Effect the second time around usually, you know, catch things they didn't see the first time around, and it completes it as a story.
I like the little details that you did, like the little girl, Amir's daughter, about four or five. She has an imaginary friend.
She had what?
She has an imaginary friend.
Yes. Exactly. And she's my daughter, you know that.
I thought so. I was going to ask you that.
Yes, she's my daughter, and it made the scene even more authentic. And I gave her an imaginary friend because you know, she had to create one as a result of me not being very present.
And now the hat you wear in the movie. Is that a hat you normally wear?
Well, quite often, actually. It's one of those films, and the way I make movies, I'm not a trained actor. I'm not somebody who's ever thought that I would, you know, be acting in films. Actually, people have known me in this town for many years, and all of a sudden I'm coming out in films that I'm directing and acting, and people are responding to me as an actor. But the way for me to make it simple is to be, you know, like I don't like to stretch that far into areas that require real acting skills. So I'm you know, when I take a hat that I'm using, you know, throughout the day, and I put it in the movie, it reminds me that I'm having a good time. You know, the minute they're giving me, you know, something which the costume designers are putting on my shoulders, all of a sudden, you know, it becomes, you know, I mean, there's something that that subconsciously probably makes you, you know, triggers on buttons that puts you that puts you on guard because all of a sudden you're acting, you know, and when you, when you're acting, you know, you start realizing that there is the pressure of delivering, as opposed to simply being and, you know, purging and, you know, allowing for the moments to unfold organically and with whatever that comes in its direction that you can capture that enhances it and provides better entertainment. So my method of working is unconventional. It's very out of the box. I allow for improvisational work. I don't give a script to the actors, you know, but that also forces me to pick actors or individuals who have an intellect that can really contribute very fast.
Wow.
To the story that I want to tell.
Philippe, what is the catalyst that brought this movie into your sight?
Well, I'm doing, you know, I thematically, you know, I wanted to do a series of small movies that one day I could, you know, hand over to my daughter when she's an adult and have those be, you know, a representation of who her father is and my thought process and where my mind is at, because it's a way of, you know, existing on with her at a time where I may no longer be here, you know. So that's initially what drove me. Is one day I woke up and I had this being in my life that I just completely adore, and she's my daughter, and I want to have a relationship with her that really gives us a chance to know each other. But because she's a child, you know, she may never have a chance to know me as an adult, I thought, because, you know, life has its bumps and one can take you elsewhere. You know, so I decided that I would make movies that one day she'd be able to watch, and that those would give her a better idea of who her father is. And so thematically, I've decided to make movies that were possibly about the mindset, the, you know, spiritual movies, without sounding corny, about wanting to teach people. There's nothing I want to teach, because there's nothing I know for sure, other than the fact that, you know, life is a journey, and we know where point A is, and we don't know where point B is, because otherwise it'd be a trip and not a journey. So I decided to make those little movies that show that life is a journey, and that characters evolve, and that circumstances, you know, allow you to change and to grow, and that the burden of our own, the burden of things like guilt, you know, and approval and other things that you know, we all have or seek in life, you know, it puts the brakes on our own growth as people. And at some point, you know, it's about dropping it and just going with it, you know, and surrendering to a point. So my films are mostly about that.
Philippe, what was your daughter's imprint as far as working with you in the film? Has she ever done this before? And if not, you know, how did she feel about this?
Who's that? I'm sorry?
Your daughter, what was your daughter's thoughts about working with you in this film? Has she worked with you before in another film, or is this the first?
In Hollywood Buddha, I put my wife and my mother and people I picked, you know, at gas stations. And so in Hollywood Buddha, it wasn't nepotism. It was, you know, just doing anything I could to get anyone who would act with me. And it turned out into a great little movie, and it has its magic. And actually, it's the one that has allowed me to continue on doing what I'm doing. But ripple effect, I don't know to what extent she's aware. She's aware because she's 7 years old, my daughter now. So she's aware that she was already in two movies. She was in Hollywood Buddha. She is in Ripple Effect, and she'll be in another movie that I'll be making. But I don't want to throw that on her. It's too early in life to make a thing of it, you know. I mean, so for her, it's like, okay, you know, daddy's making a movie. You want to come and play for a day, you know? But I don't want her to take this seriously. She needs to, you know, it's, you know, she this could alter, you know, someone's natural evolution, you know, as a child. I think that the spotlight is hard enough for an adult to take. You know, a child should not be under the spotlight because a child should be a child. And so I make light of it. I make fun of it. I don't have her take it seriously. It's a weekend with Dada on the set, and that's the end of it. You know.
Oh, that's certainly. I mean, I'm sure she's excited about it.
She is excited about it because you know we have screenings and people come and tell her that she's wonderful. She doesn't come to the screenings because I don't expose her to the screenings. I mean, she was at one screening that we had here in town just because her mom and came to pick me up at the end of it, and friends came to her and told her that they loved her in the movie, so it puts a big grin on her face. But friends come to the house who have seen the movie and they tell her that they thought she was great in it, and without knowing exactly what it means, she's amused by it.
Now, watching you wrote the movie. Did you think of different outcomes while you were writing it? If a character had done something differently, then a different outcome would have happened?
The story was the story from the very beginning, so you cannot really get into a production unless you lay out a blueprint that just reveals a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if you sway too much from that blueprint, then you may end up having great scenes that they don't belong in a movie anymore. You know, so you need to unfold the process, you know, around a certain blueprint where at least I, as a director, need to know where it's going, because otherwise it becomes very dangerous.
Now you mentioned just earlier that the actress didn't have a script.
Yes.
So how does that work?
Well, I write. I write a script, but I don't give it to the actors. I write a script for myself, because that's how I end up laying out, creating a production blueprint. I couldn't do it if I didn't have a script, or at least a very thorough treatment. I need to know where I'm shooting, what are my locations, what for, and what I'm trying to do in those scenes, and how it all ties up together. But then once I've written it in my own mind, I just toss it right out of the window, and I show up on a set without a script, and I don't give it to the actors. Although I did hand a couple of pages of dialogue at some point when one of them was struggling with what the scene was truly about, all was done is a quick read, and then I don't want people to read the lines. I think there's something very stifling about reading lines. You know, I want people to be tuned into their emotion, and my job as a director is to set up a certain atmosphere and allow the people who I invite to be part of the process to be the best they can within a context that they understand and a story that they support. Because then, you know, you've got magic that starts happening. You've got people who become the character as opposed to, you know, trying to serve a script which establishes who the character, you know, is on the page already. And I think that the way I work is one that establishes to a certain extent what the character is. I'm very specific as to the broader context of what the movie is about and what the story is about and how I want it to materialize, but then I allow for people to be the very best they can be, and then the fact that I'm also an actor in this film, it allows me as a director to do things twice, because the first thing that I do as a director, I tell everybody what the scene is about, and so everybody gets it, and then I'm stepping into the scene as an actor, and in my own improvisational work, you know, I just start giving the scene what I think it needs. And in a way, I'm feeding the scene, you know, further directing, you know, through my own acting, because at that point, the actors have to respond to me as an actor, and it's no longer the director anymore who's telling them. It's the director who told them already, and now he's confirming it through his own acting in a scene to which they have to respond. And that allows for a certain way of doing, you know the work, and it works for me, and I'll continue doing that always.
Now, who came with what story? You or Forrest? That scene where you said the story, maybe not.
Okay. Well, the story is me, and because I wrote the ripple effect. In the story that I wrote, Forrest and I were on top of the hill, overseeing the story, and I was completely burdened and destroyed by my guilt, and I was there pretty much on my knees. Not on my knees sexually, but basically, you know, just completely vulnerable and asking for forgiveness in a way, and that his character was to basically set me free and expand my thinking into what his mindset is about for that specific scene. So when Forrest and I, when Forrest stepped into that scene, he knew that this is what needed to be accomplished. Now, the dialogue, the scene itself, you know, is something where we've also improvised. We had rehearsed a couple of things before as to, you know, and then Forrest basically said the maybe not story within the context that I had laid out.
Oh, so. Because I had heard that story before, but it was just so perfect for that scene.
Yes. You know, I think it is the cherry in the movie. And I'm forever grateful to Forrest for that.
Philip, will you do me a favor and bring some insight into what kind of child you were growing up?
Well, you know, I was born in Beirut, Lebanon. My father is French. My mother is Lebanese. And so I was, you know, I have a French name because of my father, but yet I grew up in a country where I was perceived and looked at as an exotic kid because everybody else was not half French. So I grew up very privileged in Lebanon because my grandfather was the president of the country on my mother's side. So that means I had first row seats to the Lebanese saga. Political, sociological, and all that happened in the past, you know, 40 years in Lebanon, because I was there in my grandfather's house, and it was the epicenter of much of what was happening when I was a child. So I was exposed very quickly to sociology and mindsets and politics and all of that while still being very much part of the French culture because my father is French and very early in life I was a swimmer and an athlete, so I was going back and forth between Beirut and Paris because in France, you know, I quickly qualified to be a swimmer on the French national swim team, and I was competing in Europe. So my life really was back and forth between Paris and Beirut from rather early in life. But I have to say that as a child, you know, I had a stronger connection with the people who were waiting on us and who were serving us and who were driving us than the other people. So although I do come from a privileged background and I have fantastic memory of my childhood, I think it was poetic in many, many different ways.
Were you into art at all?
I'm sorry?
Were you into art, into imagery, into art?
My mom actually is a fantastic painter. She was already a painter, so I grew up with my mom painting, and now my mom is a well-known painter. I mean, her work as a painter is auctioned at Sotheby's and Christie's in Europe quite often, and she exists as a painter. She lived in Venice, California, actually, around the corner from me.
Oh.
She's an extremely active member of the Venice art scene. So yes, I grew up with my mom as a painter, but we grew up in Lebanon. I grew up, in Lebanon. And Lebanon, people were not as keen towards art and definitely not film because that was something that didn't really belong. It wasn't part of the Lebanese culture, which means that, you know, for me to the minute I was thinking of stories and of movies as a kid, but I knew that I had to export myself at some point and go to places where this could happen. And you know, I naturally found my way into the U.S. and I've been here for 20 plus years now working on it.
How old were you when you thought about doing stories at that time?
Well, I was doing stories when I was 6 and 7 and 8, but those were my imagination was first, never stopped. You know, I always put together little stories. I always, you know, imagine things like children do, but I take it one step further where I just give a resolution to just wacky thoughts and ideas. I mean, a lot of waste of time because I could just trip out into a story and spend hours on it very early in life, and that was wasted time. Instead of being behind books in school and studying, I would think of how, you know, the moon could be colonized one day. You know?
Yeah, my daughter thinks that way too.
She does think very much that way, and so she's got her imaginary friends, and she's always thinking. I know my daughter is actually, you know, I just so much recognize myself as a child every time I see my daughter, and it just makes me smile, and she's just very much a mix of her mother and I, but there are so many things about me that I recognize in her, and it took me a while to realize that that's the guy I am, and now she confirms that that's the guy I am because she gives me her own little samples of my own madness at times.
I had a question and I just left.
Yeah.
When I know what I was going to say. When I was looking for your bio and your picture on the internet, there is hardly anything. Even under Ripple Effect, there's a blank for your picture.
Yeah.
And you have a very small bio, so I thought you're very humble and you want to be kind of in the background.
Well, I'm not planning on being in the forefront. You know, I don't have, you know, any real plans. Like, I'm not going to go out of my way to put a picture of myself, you know, on the internet. If there is one that happens, you know, I'm not going to go out of my way to take it out either. I'm I'm not about that. You see, the thing is, I'm not a promoter. I'm trying not to be a promoter. Filmmakers are forced in the competitive environment that the studio system provides. You know, filmmakers are forced at some point to become promoters, and the talent is no longer about being a good filmmaker and an authentic one. It's also about being a good hustler quite often, so that you differentiate yourself from others, you know, any way you can. And it's just a bit of a racy game for me to play, and the kind of work that I'm interested in doing just doesn't lend itself to that dynamic. It's just too much energy, and I'm not looking, you know, approval, as I was saying earlier, it's one of those very dangerous things where, you know, a bad review and a bad critic is just as damaging or pretty much as a good one. Because it puts you on the waiting end of what other people think, as opposed to, you know, just doing your work and not worrying about it, and the only thing that counts is that the core of you remains honest. And so my work is more about being as honest as I can with what I'm doing, and, you know, it can appear to be a bit rough on the edges at times because I work with little money and I'm not competing with the studio system and I'm not working on those fancy shots. You know, at the end of it, my only special effect in a movie, and forever it will be the case, is the human complexity. I mean, that is the most extraordinary special effect one can bring to the screen, because the rest is a matter of technology, and people are going to continue to come up with better things. And that's where I'm going to differentiate myself from other people, is that I want, you know, I'm interested in how complex humanity is and how vulnerable we are and what's our path towards growth, so that it's a better experience, at least for me. And I do it all in a way where it is, in a way, my own therapy, because I'm not trying to heal people. I'm trying to heal myself, and I'm not trying to teach people either. I'm trying to learn as I go. So that is really where I'm at. So the process of putting myself up and flaunting anything that I'm doing and promoting it becomes one that is it's a process that would aspire to other things that I'm interested in life. You know.
Well, in the ripple effect in the movie, Amir is into promoting his work, and I thought that is probably a piece that you didn't want in your life because he's not happy doing that. What you were thinking when you wrote that?
I wanted him as a promoter at the beginning because I knew when I did this movie that Amir would end up on his knees at the very end of the movie and that this would be a spiritual awakening of sorts. So I knew that, there's no point. I mean, if you end up a movie where you're on your knees, then you want to start off, you know, diametrically opposed, you know, to that moment in life. So if you end up in knees, that means that you've surrendered. That means that you've opened up your mind to other things about life than that you were not exposed to before. And it is a life-altering experience that I have with Forrest Whitaker in Ripple Effect. So I knew that it was going to end that way. So I thought that I may as well start him off grinding at life, possibly a bit arrogant, you know, and not altogether the most likable character, you know, you can bring to the screen. So I wanted basically to have my character belong in the rat race like millions of people out there do. And I wanted the process to pull him out of the rat race and just expose him to a different mindset.
And I think what he discovered integrity also.
Yes.
Integrity as a result of surrendering, because again, you know, integrity is something, it's a moral term, you know, it's a moral term that also has its own, is integrity, you know, something which is anchored in our sense of tradition and society, or is integrity at the end of it, you know, a complete surrender and an instinctive understanding of the right from the wrong without trying to teach other people, because the only thing that can teach anyone in life is life itself. Anything that is told, you know, is half as valuable as anything that is lived. You know, so I think that at the end of it, you know, we all have our own lives to live, and we learn from our own lives, and people can advise us and tell us that if we do this, it's going to hurt, and we don't quite understanding how much it's going to hurt until it actually does hurt, and for that we have to have, there is great wisdom to people advising people about, you know what's good from what's bad and how bad can hurt and good be rewarding and so on. But at the end of it, we live our lives. We are driven by energies that I think control us more than us controlling them. And we fall in traps that end up defining us and our characters and revealing the best of us because, you know, every time that you're in a trap, you have to grow stronger to get out of it. And so there is something about that, I think, that... That my life is about. I've fallen into traps, you know. As a result, you know, they've made me humble. I started off my life believing I knew much more than I do today. I'm at a place in my life right now where I'm kind of going through it with big open eyes, seeing beauty in things that I didn't even notice before, you know, dismissing other things that, you know, had taken too much time and, you know, in my life a while back. And so I've become a different person than who I was 10 years ago and 15 years ago, and it's really through the process of living as opposed to the process of reading and listening to other people.
Well, your life actually is a ripple effect because Hollywood Buddha is how, actually making that movie first, is how Forrest Whitaker knew about you. So it was all a ripple effect, and plus there was some publicity around the Buddhism part.
Yeah.
Is that unwanted publicity? I mean, did that make the movie even more known?
Well, Hollywood Buddha, yeah. I mean, this is as wacky of a story as, you know, anybody's heard. I mean, I make a small I'll take the ripple effect actually one step further. You know, when my wife was pregnant, you know, I had brought all of our savings into buying us a small house in Los Angeles. And I thought that, okay, well, you know, a week into her pregnancy, it was the time to buy a small house, give her security and nest. And then I bring in an architect, you know, and I ask him to make our bedroom a little bit bigger. And we do the plans for that. And then he tells me, Philippe, because you live in a fire hazard area, you know, how about you take out the shingle from the roof? And we put some tile instead. It would be safer. And I say, you know what? It's not a bad idea. So he gives the crew that comes to the house the order to take down the roof. And what they understood is take down the house. So what happened is that I left town for 3 days, and I came back to my house, and the house was leveled all the way to the footing.
Oh my gosh.
And it was gone. The house was gone. So that same house that I had bought, you know, with pride, with every one of my nickels, you know, had disappeared. And there's no insurance claim because this is something that, you know, a crew took down. So I found myself in a huge crisis. First of all, you know, there's a bank that had loaned me half of, you know, the money to buy the house that wasn't happy about it because it wasn't the collateral, you know, they had bought into anymore. So I was forced to rebuild the house from scratch. I put a tent on my lawn, and I lived in a tent for 3 years with my wife and with my child. And I mean, I had my mom's guest house to go, you know, for everything that needed a different kind of shelter, including, you know, bath and shower and this and that. But I was 90% of my time, we were in a big tent on the lawn of my house. And at that point, I had been a producer as opposed to a director until that day, and then I decided, I say, okay, well, you know, I mean, I'm dealing with very unhealthy emotions. The first one was to grab my architect and wring his neck, and then I just went to him one day wanting to do that, and then I saw this guy who was petrified and as scared as I was, disturbed, realizing that he had possibly made a mistake in giving orders to people or they misunderstood him. He knew that for me it was a loss of money, and he didn't have the money that I could even sue him for that. So at that point I decided that, you know what, I mean, something happened in me where this person that I was angry at, you know, I decided that I would not be angry at him. And I think that it's the first mature decision that I ever did in my life, because my natural instincts were just to go and rip him apart, you know. But then I just couldn't. I saw the guy in him who was scared. I saw the guy in him who basically realized that it was an error. And I said, okay, well, now if that happened, what's the reason why this happened, you know? And I decided to give another reason to the house going down than this guy's mistake. And I determined at that point that it was my life that needed to be changed and rebuilt around a better understanding of who I am. And at that point, you know, I lived in a tent and I rebuilt the house, and I made myself a director as opposed to going on as a producer, which is truly what I had done over the years before that. And I decided I'm going to do something reckless and crazy and narcissistic and vain, and people are going to hate me for it, and I'm going to just go ahead and dye my hair blonde and shoot a little movie that I'm acting in and I'm also directing. I wanted to purge out in one experience all of my creative juices, you know, to confirm to myself that I had, you know, certain abilities that, you know, other people didn't know about, and including myself. And as a result, I made Hollywood Boudon. Now,
well,
what happened with Hollywood Buddha is that this small home movie that I had created, you know, became a buzz movie, and people were talking about it and liking it. And it did the festival circuit, and it was doing great, and it won festivals, and, you know, and people were starting to recognize me for Hollywood Buddha, and we even gave it a small release in a couple of art houses in Los Angeles, and it was doing well. And an ad agency decided to do a billboard. And they did a billboard digitally, graphically, of me sitting on a giant Buddha head. And what happened at that point, the billboard went up, and they had 30 of them in Los Angeles. They were big billboards of me sitting on a Buddha. Hello?
Go ahead. That's to say how long we have to...
Well, 90 seconds, I heard. So I'm going to just summarize. So
okay.
What happened is that, my billboard basically became a big controversy with the Buddhists, and 40 Buddhists went on a hunger strike because of my billboard. And I was forced to take down my billboard and to stop the release of Hollywood Buddha. And a movie that had started... A movie that had started with all the good intentions you can imagine turned out, to become, an infamous project, and I became quickly, just somebody the Buddhists did not like as a result of this billboard being out there, and I had to just put an apology and remove the billboards from the city and stop the release of the movie. But Hollywood Buddha, had already become the movie that it is, and it had given me that little boost to go on making Ripple Effect.
Well, you certainly have a ripple effect going on, and I'm sure that it's going to keep going.
Yeah, and a ripple effect goes out to people that watch the movie as well. It's really brilliant in what you have done. We want to thank you for being with us. It's just been such a gift in our pocket.
And we want people listening that are in the San Jose area to be sure to go to the cinema in San Jose and see it.
Mm-hmm. And head to our TazAndPoloShow.com to be able to listen to this archive again. I'm sure you will want to do that.
And thank you, Philippe, because this was just a wonderful interview.
Well, thank you for having me.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You too.
Well, Taz... Until next week.